Baby, it's a line. I chance we're crossing the same roads all at one time. Even if you say it coming, no time to play out gracefully. One thing I know for sure, be no doubt when you see you are. Grass might dab in the middle of it. Grass might dab in the middle. We are grass might dab.
Secret truth. Through forgiveness we awaken, transforming information and knowledge into wisdom.
Welcome to The Secret Truth. I'm George Butler. We've got a good program for you this evening. Greg Reese starts off, and he's saying that there's nanotechnology in all these shots and vaccines and things like that, and gosh, it's creating circuits and so forth. And then we're going to start off after that with an Aldous Huxley interview by Mike Wallace, 1958. He takes us way back. And then we're going to come forward with Victor David Hansen talking about his latest book, The Dying Citizen. And then we're going to discuss some of these things about the perfect society and the ideal, you know, utilitarian society and so forth to end the program. But here we go with Greg Reese.
Ricardo Delgado has a master's in biostatistics. His postgraduate studies included microbiology, epidemiology, and immunology. He is the founder of the Fifth Column. Delgado has published videos of electron microscopy taken at the University of Almeria in Spain, of the Pfizer mRNA vaccine, showing what can best be described as self-organizing nanostructures. The videos show that as the Pfizer mRNA vaccine evaporates, nano-sized structures begin to form. Multiple structures that appear to be the same things. Things that look like microchips and electronic circuitry. Pfizer has reportedly made 33 different batches, which have all been cataloged in a database, some dangerous and others seemingly innocuous. So these things maybe aren't in every vial. But the FDA has said that they need 75 years to tell us all the details, so maybe they are. At a World Economic Forum 2018 conference, the chief executive officer of Pfizer expressed excitement for invasive nanotech, referring to the recent FDA approval of a tablet with a sensor that can notify medical authorities of compliance.
It is a basically biological chip that it is in the tablet. And once you take the tablet and dissolves into your stomach, sends a signal that you took the tablet. So imagine the applications of that, compliance.
Later that year, a nano transistor chip is unveiled that replaces silicone with air. Just this week, a COVID implantable microchip developer claimed we will be chipped whether we like it or not. There has been much talk about graphene oxide and nanotech in the vaccines, which the media vehemently claims is not true. But how would they know? And why would anyone trust a word that they say about any of this? If there are nanocircuits being created within the bodies of the vaccinated, this would explain the videos we've seen of IP addresses coming from the jabbed. A newly activated network of nanocircuits, unique to each individual. One of the leading experts of nanotechnology, Charles Lieber, has written patents describing a technology that has the potential to self-assemble into tiny computer systems capable of controlling human neurology, which is exactly what Delgado's electron microscopy of the Pfizer jab appears to be. Charles Lieber was just convicted on numerous crimes for working with the communist Chinese in Wuhan, where Pfizer ran a research and development facility. Elon Musk expects to be implanting his Neuralink into human beings this year and claims that they could put you fully into virtual reality, as if this is somehow important for humanity. For humanity, it isn't, but for the transhumanist, it's a necessity. And if you listen to the psychopaths orchestrating all of this, transhumanism is officially their stated goal. And they won't need Elon's implantable chip. With injectable nano-sized circuitry in the human brain and nervous system, non-intrusive wearable tech will do the job just fine. And this is rapidly being developed by Wellcome Leap, a privately run umbrella corporation connecting DARPA, Silicon Valley, and the military, who has tripled their network in less than a year, boasting success for the deadly mRNA vaccines and pushing to accelerate new ones designed to correct every so-called flaw of the human psyche that stands in the way of productivity to an authoritarian state run by artificial intelligence that monitors and controls their neurological functions 24/7. This is exactly what they say they want by the year 2030. So either the vaccines are a way of interfacing the new transhuman with AI technology, or they're lying, and it's all about depopulation. Which is what the latest data is showing. Natural News recently estimated billions of deaths if it isn't stopped in the next year. It obviously isn't about public health, and whether it's about depopulation or transhumanism, it is a threat to all of humanity. We could ponder until the end about why anyone would want to do this. But the real question is, why are we letting them? Reporting for InfoWars, this is Greg Rees.
This is getting very, very creepy, but we've got to continue on here. But anyway, Greg Rees really comes out with some very, very good pronouncements. He does really excellent research. But here we go to a interview from the past, 1958, Mike Wallace interviewing Aldous Huxley, author of Brave New World, Return to Brave New World, and he has some very important things to say about the individual and about technology, and he's predicting about television being used in bad ways and other things. But we have to get back to individual freedoms and rights, and that's protected in a republic, not a democracy. In a democracy, you can end up having a tyranny of the majority, and that's what we're having now. The majority is voting themselves benefits, and the Democratic Party is providing many of those programs. So here we go with a really insightful. I'm going to put up on the secrettruth.com site, I'm going to put up click-offs so you'll be able to listen to this whole interview. But these were excerpts that I thought that were very important on this interview. So here we go with Aldous Huxley, interviewed by Mike Wallace.
But the point is, it seems to me, that there are methods at present available, methods superior in some respects to Hitler's method, which could be used in a bad situation. I mean, what I feel very strongly is that we mustn't be caught by surprise by our own advancing technology. This has happened again and again in history. Technology has advanced, and this changes social conditions, and suddenly people have found themselves in a situation which they didn't foresee and doing all sorts of things they didn't really want to do.
Well, now, what do you mean? Do you mean that we develop our television, but we don't know how to use it correctly? Is that the point that you're making?
Well, at present, the television, I think, is being used quite harmlessly. It's being used, I think, I would feel it's being used too much to distract everybody all the time. But, I mean, imagine, which must be the situation in all communist countries, where the television, where it exists, is always saying the same thing the whole time, is always driving along. It's not creating a wide front of distraction. It's creating a one-pointed drumming in of a single idea all the time. It's obviously an immensely powerful instrument.
Mm-hmm. So you're talking about the potential misuse of the instrument.
Exactly. We have, of course, all technology is in itself morally neutral. These are just powers which can either be used well or ill. It's the same thing with atomic energy. We can either use it to blow ourselves up, or we can use it as a substitute for the coal and the oil which are running out.
You've even written about the use of drugs in this light.
Well, now, this is a very interesting subject. I mean, in this book that you mentioned, this book of mine, Brave New World, I postulated a substance called Soma, which was a very versatile drug. It would make people feel happy in small doses. It would make them see visions in medium doses, and it would send them to sleep in large doses. Well, I don't think such a drug exists now, nor do I think it will ever exist, but we do have drugs which will do some of these things. And I think it's quite on the cards that we may have drugs which will profoundly change our mental states without doing us any harm. I mean, this is the pharmacological revolution which has taken place, that we have now powerful mind-changing drugs which, physiologically speaking, are almost costless. I mean, they are not like opium or like cocaine, which do change the state of mind, but leave terrible results physiologically and morally.
Mr. Huxley, in your new essays, you state that these various enemies of freedom are pushing us toward a real-life, brave new world, and you say that it's awaiting us just around the corner. First of all, can you detail for us what life in this brave new world which you fear so much, what life might be like?
Well, to start with, I think this kind of the dictatorship of the future, I think will be very unlike the dictatorships which we've been familiar with in the immediate past. I mean, take another book prophesying the future, which was a very remarkable book, George Orwell's 1984. Mm-hmm. Well, this book was written at the height of the Stalinist regime and just after the Hitler regime. And there he foresaw a dictatorship using entirely the methods of terror, the methods of physical violence. Now, I think what is going to happen in the future is the dictators will find, as the old saying goes, that you can do everything with bayonets except sit on them. That if you want to preserve your power indefinitely, you have to get the consent of the ruled. And this they will do partly by drugs, as I foresaw in Brave New World, partly by these new techniques of propaganda. They will do it by bypassing the sort of rational side of man and appealing to his subconscious and his deeper emotions and his physiology even, and so making him actually love his slavery. I mean, I think this is the danger, that actually people may be in some ways happy under the new regime, but they will be happy in a situation where they oughtn't to be happy.
But let me ask you this. You're talking about a world that could take place within the confines of a totalitarian state. Let's become more immediate, more urgent about it. We believe, anyway, that we live in democracy here in the United States. Do you believe that this brave new world that you talk about could, let's say, in the next quarter century, the next century, could come here to our shores?
I think it could. I mean, that's why I feel it's so extremely important here and now to start thinking about these problems, not to let ourselves be taken by surprise by the new advances in technology. I mean, for example, in regard to the use of the drugs, we know there's enough evidence now for us to be able, on the basis of this evidence and using a certain amount of creative imagination, to foresee the kind of uses which could be made by people of bad will with these things, and to attempt to forestall this. And in the same way, I think with these other methods of propaganda, we can foresee and we can do a good deal to forestall. I mean, after all, the price of freedom is eternal vigilance.
You write in Enemies of Freedom, you write specifically about the United States. You say this, writing about American political campaigns. You say, all that is needed is money and a candidate who can be coached to look sincere. Political principles and plans for specific action have come to lose most of their importance. The personality of a candidate, the way he is projected by the advertising experts, are the things that really matter.
Well, this is, during the last campaign, there was a great deal of this kind of statement by the advertising managers of the campaign parties, this idea that the candidates had to be merchandised as though they were soap or toothpaste, and that you had to depend entirely on the personality. I mean, the personality is important, but there are certainly people with an extremely amiable personality, particularly on TV, who might not necessarily be very good in positions of political trust.
Well, do you feel that men like Eisenhower, Stevenson, Nixon, with knowledge of forethought, were trying to pull the wool over the eyes of the American public?
No, but they were being advised by powerful advertising agencies who were making campaigns of a quite different kind from what had been made before. And I think we shall see probably all kinds of new devices coming into the picture. I mean, for example, this thing which got a good deal of publicity last autumn, a subliminal projection. I mean, as it stands, this thing, I think, is of no menace to us at the moment. But I was talking the other day to one of the people who has done most experimental work in the psychological laboratory with this, who was saying precisely this, that it is not at the moment a danger, but once you've established a principle that something works, you can be absolutely sure that the technology of it is going to improve steadily. And his view of the subject was that, maybe they will use it to some extent in the 1960 campaign, but they will probably use it a good deal and much more effectively in the 1964 campaign, because this is the kind of rate at which technology advances.
And we'll be persuaded to vote for a candidate that we do not know that we are being persuaded to vote for.
Exactly. I mean, this is a rather alarming feature, that you're being persuaded below the level of choice and reason.
In regard to advertising, which you mentioned just a little ago, in your writing, particularly in Enemies of Freedom, you attack Madison Avenue, which controls most of our television and radio advertising, newspaper advertising, and so forth. Why do you consistently attack the advertising agency?
Well, no, I think that advertisement plays a very necessary role, but the danger, it seems to me, in a democracy is this. I mean, what does a democracy depend on? A democracy depends on the individual voter making an intelligent and rational choice for what he regards as his enlightened self-interest in any given circumstance. But what these people are doing, I mean, what both for their particular purposes, for selling goods, and the dictatorial propagandists are doing, is to try to bypass the rational side of man and to appeal directly to these unconscious forces below the surface, so that you are, in a way, making nonsense of the whole democratic procedure, which is based on conscious choice on rational grounds.
Of course, well, maybe you have just answered this next question, because in your essay you write about television commercials, not just political commercials, but television commercials as such, and how, as you put it, today's children walk around singing beer commercials and toothpaste commercials. And then you link this phenomenon in some way with the dangers of a dictatorship. Now, could you spell out the connection, or how do you feel that you have done so sufficiently?
Well, I mean, here, Kate, this whole question of children, I think, is a terribly important one, because children are quite clearly much more suggestible than the average grown-up. And again, suppose that for one reason or another, all the propaganda was in the hands of one or very few agencies, you would have an extraordinarily powerful force playing on these children, who after all are going to grow up and be adults quite soon. I do think that this is not an immediate threat, but it remains a possible threat. And
you said something to the effect in your essay that the children of Europe used to be called cannon fodder, and here in the United States they are television and radio fodder.
Well, after all, you can read in the trade journals the most lyrical accounts of how necessary it is to get hold of the children, because then they will be loyal brand buyers later on.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, again, you just translate this into political terms. The dictator says they will be loyal ideology buyers when they're grown up.
We hear so much about brainwashing as used by the communists. Do you see any brainwashing other than that which we've just been talking about that is used here in the United States? Other forms of brainwashing?
Not in the form that has been used in China and in Russia, because this is essentially the application of propaganda methods, the most violent kind, to individuals. It's not a shotgun method like the advertising method. It's a way of getting hold of the person and playing both on his physiology and his psychology till he really breaks down, and then you can implant a new idea in his head. I mean, the descriptions of the methods are really blood-curdling when you read them, and not only the methods applied to political prisoners, but the methods applied, for example, to the training of the young communist administrators and missionaries, they receive an incredibly tough kind of training, which may cause about 25% of them to break down or commit suicide, but produces 75% of completely one-pointed fanatics.
The question, of course, that keeps coming back to my mind is this. Obviously, politics in themselves are not evil. Television is not in itself evil. Atomic energy is not evil. And yet you seem to fear that it will be used in an evil way. Why is it that the right people will not, in your estimation, use them? Why is it that the wrong people will use these various devices and for the wrong motives?
Well, I think one of the reasons is that these are all instruments for obtaining power, and obviously the passion for power is one of the most moving passions that exist in man, and after all, all democracies are based on the proposition that power is very dangerous and that it's extremely important not to let any one man or any one small group have too much power for too long a time. After all, what are the British and American constitutions except devices for limiting power? And all these new devices are extremely efficient instruments for the imposition of power by small groups over larger masses.
Well, you ask this question yourself in Enemies of Freedom. I'll put your own question back to you. You ask this. In an age of accelerating overpopulation, of accelerating overorganization, and ever more efficient means of mass communication, how can we preserve the integrity and reassert the value of the human individual? You put the question. Now here's your chance to answer it, Mr. Huxley.
Well, this is obviously, first of all, it's a question of education. I think it's terribly important to insist on individual values. I mean, what is... There is a tendency, as you probably read a book by White, The Organization Man, a very interesting, valuable book, I think, where he speaks about the new type of group morality, group ethic, which speaks about the group as though the group were somehow more important than the individual. But this seems, as far as I'm concerned, to be in contradiction with what we know about the genetical makeup of human beings, that every human being is unique. And it is, of course, on this genetical basis that the whole idea of the value of freedom is based. And I think it's extremely important for us to stress this in all our educational life. And I would say it's also very important to teach people to be on their guard against the sort of verbal booby traps into which they're always being led, to analyze the kind of things that are said to them. Well, I think there is this whole educational side, and I think there are many more things that one could do to strengthen people and to make them more aware of what was being done.
You're a prophet of decentralization.
Well, yes, if this is feasible. It's one of the tragedies, it seems to me. I mean, many people have been talking about the importance of decentralization in order to give back to the voter a sense of direct power. I mean, the voter in an enormous electorate feels quite impotent, and his vote seems to count for nothing. This is not true where the electorate is small and where he is dealing with a group which he can manage and understand. And if one can, as Jefferson, after all, suggested, break up the units into smaller and smaller units, and so get a real self-governing democracy.
Well, that was all very well in Jefferson's day, but how can we revamp our economic system and decentralize and at the same time meet militarily and economically the tough challenge of a country like Soviet Russia?
Well, I think the answer to that is that there are, it seems to me that the production, industrial production, is of two kinds. I mean, there are some kinds of industrial production which obviously need the most tremendously high centralization, like the making of automobiles, for example. But there are many other kinds where you could decentralize quite easily and probably quite economically, and that you would then have this kind of decentralized life. After all, you begin to see it now if you travel through the South, this decentralized textile industry which is springing up there.
Mr. Huxley, let me ask you this. quite seriously. Is freedom necessary?
As far as I'm concerned, it is, yes.
Why? Is it necessary for a productive society?
Yes, I should say it is. I mean, a genuinely productive society. I mean, I think you could produce plenty of goods without much freedom. But I think the whole sort of creative life of man is ultimately impossible without a considerable measure of individual freedom, of that initiative, creation, all these things which we value, and I think value properly, are impossible without a large measure of freedom.
Well, Mr. Huxley, take a look again at...
He predicted quite a bit. He also referred to George Orwell's 1984, and these were really predictors of what we're experiencing now. At the time that Aldous Huxley did that interview with Mike Wallace, it was 1958. They did play a clip of JFK, John Kennedy, in Berlin, okay, saying, "Ich bin ein Berliner, I am a Berliner." And that occurred before I got over to West Berlin myself. And I wish I could have been there to experience that. And I was very, very joyful when the wall was coming down, because we did see some very awesome sights, terrible sights along the wall. And there were people, I was over there in 65, we saw people trying to come to freedom. And they were shooting at him and killing people. So this is the communist regime that ruled over East Germany for decades after World War II that finally came to an end. So I'm totally against communism and collectivism and socialism, because it destroys people, it destroys societies, and it destroys what's good about societies. Next is an interview that Victor David Hansen gave about his new book. And his upcoming book is entitled The Dying Citizen. And he speaks and lectures at Hillsdale College up in Michigan. And it's the one bastion of freedom and democracy in the country left almost. But they don't take any federal monies. And they require, you know, there's freshman students and others to take the Bill of Rights and the Constitution and understand what the Declaration of Independence was all about. We have created, our founding fathers created a system that eventually provided the civil rights for those minorities that were out there fighting on the front lines to attain. So other systems in the world wouldn't even allow them to protest like our system did. So that's what's good about our system. And we can't judge, you know, the past. And I think that's what Victor David Hansen is saying. Look, we're dredging up stuff 40, 50, 100, 200 years ago. I'm not guilty of. And Victor David Hansen is not guilty. And most people in the country are not guilty of. But they're dredging these things up and casting guilt on us. And trying to gain political power, you know, through that mechanism. Here we go with Victor David Hansen.
Government by nature has people who master its intricacies. They're not elected. So these people were not elected, but even when monarchs come in, they have to rely on these other people.
They need the bureaucrats.
And when you apply that to democracy, it's contradictory to the spirit of a citizen, legislator, or executive, or judge. And so they were very wary of that. The government was pretty small. The federal government basically dealt with tariffs, and it didn't get into civil legislation. So we started to expand. And we expanded on the notion that equality gradually was to its fruition today is now equity. It's not equality of opportunity. It's equality of result. Now, you and I are not born equally. I don't know. You might have better health, worse health. Your IQ is probably higher than mine. You're
doubtful, but
I may be
on.
Luckier than you. You may be luckier than I. But if the government says we're going to be equal, then it needs enormous powers of coercion to make you go down and me go up. And so that requires a huge government. And that was what the philosophical tradition warned about. And yet we've got 2 million people in the federal government, and about 40% of Americans work for some sort of government. And trivial or the everyday, when you're driving down the 99 or I-5 and you see a road construction and there's girders all over the road and there's guys working, you think, I could sue that guy. It's the most dangerous work site. And then you say, Caltrans. I can't sue them. They're the government. But if a private contractor did that, and I'm speaking as a private farmer, right. It's dangerous. So as we know from the Soviet, when government is everything, you have no power of redress. And then second, at the existential level, what is Lois Lerner, IRS, Commissioner General Milley, Chairman of the Joint Chiefs, John Brennan,
James Clapper,
John Brennan, head of the CIA.
CIA, right.
Let's be fair to all of them. James Clapper, Director of National Intelligence. We can add in, if we want, Andrew McCabe, Acting Deputy FBI, and James Comey. What do they all have in common? They're completely, we'll put in Anthony Fauci because you've had guests that talked about that. They're never responsible for the consequences of their own ideology. So if John Brennan says, well, I lied, I admit that, I didn't tell the truth about the Senate commuters that we and the CIA surveil. Or, yes, there were people who were killed on drone, I misspoke, under oath. Try that with the IRS. Or when James Clapper says, well, the NSA does surveil people, but I gave the least untruthful answer. Or Lois Lerner said, well, we did use political considerations to target these nonprofit groups and delay them before the election of 2012. Or General Milley said, well, you know, I really didn't break the chain of command by interrupting the protocols about nuclear codes. Or violating Article 88 of the Uniform Court of Military Justice by calling my commander-in-chief a Nazi or Hitlerian. That's alleged in Bob Woodward's book. I could go on, but you have this elite that because they're like an amoeba and they're not accountable and they're judge, jury, executioner. They're executive, judicial, legislative power.
The rules do not apply to them.
And that's why they make
And they also rules. Cannot be voted out of office.
Yeah. I was very naive. I was a classicist and a farmer. And then I learned one day, I think it was at the age of 26, I didn't own the raisin crop that I was growing. The federal government called the Raisin Administrative Committee owned it. And so all of a sudden, the price fell out in 1980. Two, three, I thought, oh, wow, it doesn't make sense to send the crop.
Right.
I'll just pack it and send it at farmer's market. And they said, no, you don't. The Raisin Administrative can set aside a reserve tonnage. This year it's 70%. 70% of that crop is ours. You don't own it. We're going to take it, and we're going to make cattle feed or throw it away or send it to Europe for free. I said, but you don't own it. You don't own the... Yes, you do. And they, you know, it took a 30-year lawsuit for one grower that challenged it. So it's too big, and it's too unaccountable, and it does a lot of things that are very scary, and we're watching it now, whether it's the Pentagon or an intelligence Eisenhower said, beware of the military-industrial complex. Now I think we're going to have to say, beware of the military-industrial intelligence and investigative complex to encompass these bureaucracies.
Globalism. The dying citizen. You cite the widespread belief among elites, quote, that Americans are becoming citizens of the world. An ancient...
A good word in Greek.
An ancient but unworkable idea of cosmopolitanism has reemerged. Close quote. An ancient... Like, so
cosmos, you know, universe, yes. Politeis, citizen. Socrates and Diogenes supposedly said it.
Okay.
Supposedly.
But I think of this idea of citizenship of the world, this idea comes to us because air travel is cheap and easy, because it's very easy to communicate with anybody on the face of the planet who's hooked up to the internet. With WhatsApp, it's free to call Europe. I think of this as as technology erasing our sense of citizenship, of nationality. But then Victor says this is an ancient idea.
Yes.
Explain.
Well, I think what's happened in the last 30 years, what you talk about, the global inclusivity of cell phones and dish TV, jet travel, has been confused that because we all wear tie-dye T-shirts and flip-flops and jeans, whatever country we're in, or we say, okay, man, or the F word, or you can go to Argentina, or you can go to Taiwan and hear rap music, we're all right. In the brotherhood of man. We're not. As I said, 190 nations, as you read, less than half of them are consensual. So if you confuse this harmony that's a veneer, this similarity, with something existential...
It's only similarity. It's only similarity.
It's only a similarity. Right. So I'll give you an example. Where it leads to is Secretary of State Blinken asking the United Nations to investigate whether the United States is racist or not. So basically he's telling Americans, I trust an ecumenical body of nations, 60% of whom are not consensual, and they include China that has 1.4 people in camps. And they may have political reasons to find us racist, but we're going to abide by their recommendations or the criminal court or the Paris Climate Accord. It was summed up by Klaus Schwab, the architect of Davos. Remember him?
Right.
Good old Klaus Schwab. I read some of his books. And he wrote a book, The Great Reset. And if we could just get all of the elites together, a Bill Gates on one side of the table, a John Kerry, and we can get them all here, and then we can decide that there shall be an international tax code, which they're going to
which
decide.
They yes.
did. And then get rid of that Ireland undercutting everybody to get investment, and we're going to get together, we'll have diversity, we'll set quotas for diversity. We're going to run things. It's just like right out of frightening Plato's Republic with these guardians, you know, they're superior people, and they're going to talk down to people. The elite, so, philosopher king.
Victor, mental experiment. Facebook,
yeah.
2.8 billion users.
Yeah.
So since this country has a population of 330 million, we've got 80-85% of Facebook users are outside this country. Facebook has offices around the world. It pays taxes in one country after another. Why should the people who founded and run Facebook think of it as an American company?
It's not.
All right. So what should we do about Facebook? Anything?
I think we should say, if you have a competitor like Parler, and I have conflict of interest, I know the founder of Parler, and I like her a great deal, but don't try to put her out of business. And we used to treat people like you that were entrepreneurs, brilliant, successful, but mastered or rigged the game. They were called Rockefeller, Carnegie, and we had antitrust laws. So if you say, they're saying to us, Peter, if you don't want to have a Facebook account and you don't like our censorship and you don't like that we rig certain news stories, or Google is saying to us, I think 85% of the searches, and we know that they calibrate the searches on some kind of the results on political people, then go somewhere else. Sort of like saying to an African American in 1950, if you're in Alabama or Mississippi, if you don't like my lunch counter, that's a free country. Go to that other lunch counter. And he says, well, there is no other lunch counter. Oh,
can't,
I didn't
help
know
you
that.
There. Right.
Yeah, well, if you don't like Facebook, go to another. There is none. You've got a monopoly. You bought out 200 companies. And so they're monopolies.
So can I ask then, is your reading of antitrust at the turn of the 20th century, Teddy Roosevelt, great champion of antitrust, and what's going on at some basic level is ordinary middle-class Americans, who at that stage there were still a lot of farmers. Selma was still being farmed in those days. And they look at J.P. Morgan, and they look at John D. Rockefeller, and they look at Andrew Carnegie, and they say, well, I don't know the details, but that's just too big. That's just not American. It's unhealthy.
It's not bigness or size.
It's not.
It's control of the market by undercutting competitors and forcing them to sell out or offering them money or censoring the use of the product according to partisan or political views or having so much. We used to have this term dark money. Remember Jane Meyer? Dark
yes.
money?
Yes.
What
yes.
is $500 million of Mark Zuckerberg infused in the 2020 election to at particular precincts to enhance the registrar or the balloting work of the government?
So is it a test? Will it be a test for you over the next 5 or 10 years if Americans say more or less coherently, but if there's at least an impulse to say to Facebook and Amazon, YouTube, this we have to control you.
Yeah. What
is that sort of a test?
I think we did that with AT&T. We've done that a lot. Why doesn't just Amazon say, you control all of our purchases. You gained $100 billion during the lockdown. Just sell off your books or your kitchenware group to another thing. And they don't, you know, we can do that if we want. But we didn't think this up. We love these companies. And then we discovered something, that they manipulate searches, that they manipulate the order of a search, that they let the Taliban tweet, but not the former president of the United States, on Twitter. And so there are active economic, social, and political agendas, and we're not the political one. They are the political one, and they have an agenda, and they're using their power and monopolies for a particular political purpose.
And the correct response is we're citizens. Don't treat us like serfs.
The perfect The correct response is, you do your worst and we'll do our best, and may the best man win. We're the citizens, not you. And we'll see who wins.
Okay. Victor, what is to be done? So here's my thinking on reading The Dying Citizen. Education. If we're going to assimilate people, if we're going to teach Americans the importance of citizenship, education. But the people qualified to educate in this country overwhelmingly disagree with you. Right? In our colleges and universities.
I'm speaking of the college campus. I'm glad to use that euphemism. Well, disagree with
it's you and me, Victor. It's you and me. So, I mean, that's a special case. What do we make of the declining importance of citizenship to the people who instruct young American citizens?
It's tragic. When we were all in school, we had something called civics.
Yes.
And I remember when I was in first grade, we were taught how to fold the flag and march it. We were taught a whole array. I say we were taught. In my first grade class, there was about 9 who were so-called white and 31 that weren't. And very impoverished, had about a $4,000 per capita income in Selma, California in 1960. But everybody learned these protocols. And then we learned that there was a tripart government, and then our teacher would go checks and balances. And then we were talked about the crack in the Liberty Bell. And then we were given little bios, and they were not just Lou Gehrig or George, they were George Washington Carver. Yeah. And they were great inventors, Thomas Edison. So there was this inculcation.
No matter how poor, no matter where your parents came from, you were taught to be an
American.
If
there was an ideological bent to them, it wasn't racism, it wasn't capitalism, it was middle classism. And the idea was, this guy came from nothing. The Wright brothers came from nothing. And that's what it was, the middle class chauvinism, if I could. And that's what we were inculcated in. And then we decided in our infinite wisdom, the more affluent, leisured, and wealthy we are, we were going to make this university. And we said to ourselves, did we in the 60s, the family is racist, it's sexist or classist, and the church and the community and the government. So we in the university are brilliant people, and we can't be fair or disinterested because the whole society is biased. So guess what? We get to be biased. So we're going to take you, and we're not going to give you Socratic inductive education. We're going to deductively tell you that your heritage, your founding, the nature of your country is toxic. It always was, it is, and it always will be unless you listen to us. So it's an indoctrination. And it levers this effort, partly because of globalization on the coast that enriched the coast.
Right.
And that's where the universities are, aren't they? The Ivy League or Stanford or where we are today. Or USC, it's not, I mean, there are great universities in it, but that's not where the power lies. And these globalized people and the wealth, you know, endowment, $30 billion, $40 billion, so they said to us, we're going to indoctrinate you in a very noble way and make you enlightened and better, change human nature. Okay, so they did that. And in the process, people did what? It's a zero-sum game. They didn't learn language. They didn't learn philosophy. They didn't learn physics, math, at the old way. And so they became very confident but very ill-prepared, and arrogance and ignorance about the most toxic combination you can have. If you also add $1.7 trillion in debt that these universities colluded with the government, and they talk about collusion, $1.7 trillion. So these kids
are debt.
What are they going to do with a BA from Cal State San Jose in sociology when you owe $80,000? You tell me. And the university jacked up the rate of inflation, the rate of tuition above the rate of inflation annually. Mm. Why did they do that?
Victor, China. The billionaire Ray Dalio. Quote, empires rise when they are productive, financially sound, earn more than they spend, and increase assets faster than liabilities. This tends to happen when their people are well-educated, work hard, and behave civilly. Compare China with the United States on these measures, and the fundamentals clearly favor China. Close quote. Consensual government with citizenship at the heart of the entire project. Victor, Victor, Victor. That's yesterday. China is creating an entirely new model, and it works.
Well, I know you're playing devil's advocate. But whether it's Hegel or Nietzsche or Spinger, there's a whole, going back to Tacitus or Spittoni, there's a whole tradition of nihilists. And they warned us. They said that consumer capitalism, consensual government, creates affluence and leisure at untold magnitudes. And therefore, the individual must have religion, family, community, traditions, parents, fear of their grandparents looking at them from heaven or hell, whatever, to restrain the appetites. And when they are loose, and they will inevitably be loose, there's too much of a you get what we have now, if you look at our popular culture.
Decadence. Okay. The word for it is decadence.
The Romans had a word, luxus, luxury. But it meant always pejoratively. It was meant, and then China comes along and says, we look at these Western decadent people and look at them. And I just read a Chinese article. They had their pride flag. They had their gender studies at Kabul. They had George Floyd's mural. And what were they doing? They were hightailing it out. And they were different from the British. At least the British imperialists, when they imposed an enlightened culture, won. And their culture is debased. And they're leaving and losing. So that's what the Chinese think of us. And so what I suggest to all of us is that China is a pernicious model. That model that you say is winning has got 1.5 million people in concentration.
The Uyghurs.
The Uyghurs. And it is a racist society, endemically racist. During the COVID breakout, they went and looked at African-American foreign students and began to arrest them to see if they had COVID. And they created myths that came from Africa. And if you're not Han Chinese, you're not going to make it in China. Okay, so they have these ideas. And the way that we're supposed to compete with them, and I mean we have to compete from a symmetrical relationship. So if they're going to steal patents and copyrights and run up big surpluses and dump currency and manipulate the financial markets, okay, we can still beat them if we're better than they are. But what are we doing in these universities? California just passed a rule that said everybody has to learn ethnic studies in high school. Why not just say everybody has to have a knowledge of the English language or analysis or physics or math or biology? So if we're going to have a multiracial society, which we do have, why don't we make it more educated than China? And when I had students that took classical Greek from all different backgrounds, guess what? I didn't have to teach ethnic studies because everybody forgot who they were. Because it was such a difficult subject, they worked together, they dated, they married. Why don't we do that? Why don't we tell people that are impoverished, that are of Hispanic background or African American, it's my duty as someone who's better off economically to tutor you. And I'm going to give you the skills to beat the Chinese. And aggregately, we're going to beat the Chinese. And I think we could do that easily. And I also think that because it's not a consensual society, that they have a rendezvous with some problems. But I'm not going to say, oh, don't worry about the Chinese. They're a dictatorship. Or don't worry, they're racist, as a lot of people do. No, they're very smart. And they understand the Western mentality better than we do. And they are ahead. And we have to catch up. But it doesn't do any good to whine about how they cheat. The question is, don't get mad, get even. And get even with a different approach to education.
Victor, let's close with John Fitzgerald Kennedy speaking in West Berlin in 1963.
2,000 years ago, the proudest boast was, Civis Romanus sum. Today, in the world of freedom, the proudest boast is, Ich bin ein Berliner.
Not quite 6 decades ago, a president of the United States could speak a phrase in Latin, Civis Romanus sum, and take it for granted that his audience would get the reference.
And they did.
And they did. He could speak a second phrase, Ich bin ein Berliner, I am a Berliner, in the confidence that his audience would understand the concept of citizenship on which that phrase turned. I stand with the people of Berlin, a specific place in time, bordered. I stand with the nations of the West, actual nations, the United States, the United Kingdom, France, specific bounded places against the globalist challenge of communism. Can we recover the sense of history and citizenship that made that moment 6 decades ago possible?
I hope so. Because if he gave that speech on a university campus, he would be disinvited or deplatformed or canceled because they would say, well, what if you weren't a citizen? Who were the oppressed? So we got to do a couple of things. We have to say that history in the past is not melodrama where you pick winners and losers, bad guys and good guys. It's tragedy. And we in the present don't go back and use our standards and judge these people that were pre-industrial people. They didn't know whether they were going to die the next day from a ruptured appendix. They didn't, if they had far-sighted problem, they couldn't see. They didn't have glasses. We give them no allowances. And we don't ever say to you, Peter, you know, I'm really worried about our culture because 50 years from now, people are going to judge us by their standards. They're going to say a million viable infants were aborted or 7,000 African Americans were butchered in the streets and nobody stopped it. Or there's 700,000 people defecating on sidewalks and nobody stopped. That was what the sum total of us in 2012. Do we want that? And this arrogance we talked about, this ignorance of history comes a natural arrogance. So we've got to be a lot more humble and we've got to say to ourselves, you don't have to be perfect to be good. And that was a theme in the book. You just have to be better than the alternative. So what Kennedy was saying was that it wasn't perfect in Rome, but there were elements that were better than what was going on the other side of the Danube among Germanic tribes or among the Huns or the Vandals. And we have to say that. This country is better than the alternative, and we're good people, and we don't put the burden of being perfect. And who are we to judge people that were impoverished and died at 35 when we have all the technology on the shoulders of giants, their scientific developments and contributions we were the beneficiaries of, and yet the wealthier and more leisured we are, a future generation is going to say, my God, look at that culture. Where was your Beethoven? Where were your giants? And when you had people that spoke out and were, you know, individual minds, you made fun of them. Or you called them racist or sexist or transgender or homophobic. And who are you people to say that? And the answer, of course, is to a little humility, a better educational system, and unity, unity, unity. And that's why in the Dying Citizen to Finish, remember the middle class is the hope for citizenship. Remember that you have to have a sacred space with secure borders. Remember that the road to perdition is tribal affiliation rather than making it incidental, not essential to who we are. And do not trust our elite who say we need unelected, unaccountable bureaucrats who are technocrats and experts that you stupid legislators and voters don't know about. And then be careful about the unelected and the evolutionaries who say let's change the system because it doesn't benefit us. Get rid of this Supreme Court membership. Get rid of the Electoral College. It didn't hurt. It didn't help me right now. And finally, we're not citizens of the world. We're citizens of a very unique republic that is in itself with no need of input or advice from communist China or Putin's Russia or the European Union. It's a singular, most successful civilization in history, and it's the most humane. And it would be just absolutely suicide to turn over our sovereignty to those who haven't earned it.
Victor Davis Hanson, author of The Dying Citizen. Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm going to speak for about 5 minutes here. But I'm going to speak about the origin of communism and the communist movement and who's really been behind this movement. I trace it back to Rousseau in France gave rise to a communitarian type of a movement of writers, very activist writers. You also had what would be the ideal government system back then. And so it was proffered out that collective or socialism, communism, the term didn't come along until after a communitarian word was bandied about. But anyway, so what would be a good system to benefit, you know, the people, and be fair, and so forth. So they came up with this system of communism, where the state owned all the means of production. Now, what that doesn't do, it doesn't give incentive for people to do anything. So it stagnates. Communism, socialism, is a stagnant system. So The Peterloo Massacre occurred a little after 1820, right in there, in England. And that massacre gave rise to the controllers saying, uh-oh, if we let 50,000 people, meet here and protest in Peterloo Square here, we've got problems. So they connived to take over the communist movement. But what they did in taking over the communist movement, so it's been managed, okay, by the elitist of the world. That's why the corporations today, through the Tide Foundation, the Tide Centers, are the chief funders of the communist movement. But anyway, so it was controlled opposition is what we're talking about here. And in controlling that opposition, they had to deny them one key insight and finally begin to glean what that insight might be. This is speculative, and this is my idea and in my opinion, okay, is that the beauty of the American system was the word republic, because it said we rebel against a king and we're going to declare every man in the colonies, in the states, in the United States, a king. But we're going to protect those individuals, and we're going to protect them with a Bill of Rights, and we're calling that the part of the republic. That's the part of the republic. And so the controllers back here that manipulating and running the communist world, communist movement, said, okay, we'll manage it, but we won't tell them that we, the people, is a republic. And that's really escapes out of their whole movement of the socialist communist movement. And we'll maintain our super dominance through the money system. And so that's what they've done. The money power has been the base of their operations. So in a real we the people type of republic, the monopoly of money creation would be in just a few hands, and that's what we have today. Since the power of money creation is in just a few hands, then they're managing the opposition from behind the scenes. So we have public-private partnerships. We have stakeholder stuff that's coming out of World Economic Forum, see. We have all these so-called goody-goody two-shoe propositions and proposals. They're just window dressing to the ultimate thing. They're not going to give up their money power, see. They talk about, this in glowing terms of being inclusive and multicultural and all that. But they control the Aspen, they control the Tavistock, but they're not going to relinquish any money power that I see. If we establish community banks, and those community banks had true stakeholders, stakeholders, you could say, running them, then that's when you would have the money power diffused to everyone, and there would be no monopoly, or what we have today is crony capitalism. And that's what we're up against now, is crony capitalism, monopolistic Babylonian capitalism that does not benefit anyone, overall, and it's used to control. So anyway, I want to thank each and every one of you for listening tonight. And we've got to wake up. Alex is, Jones has been a little frustrated, but also I'm going to put up some click-offs for Fran Schurer. She's talking about the psychology of this. We've got to get that down. But good night, and God bless each and every one of you. Good night.